Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Trey Orndorff, a political scientist at Oklahoma Christian University, and I'm joined by the first time this week by Athena King, a political scientist at Virginia State University. Athena, it's wonderful having you on the show. Welcome.
Thank you so much. It is an honor to be here.
Oh, well, I appreciate that. We're happy that you decided to come on the show, kind of offer a different perspective. And I know that Ken is probably just happy that he's not having to get up early in the morning to do the show. He is not a morning person at all. So I just wanted to welcome you to the Politics Guys. And listeners, I hope you enjoy this week's show. And what we're going to kick off with this week, Athena, is, you know, originally we weren't sure if we were going to take on the Kavanaugh issue, the show. We've done it a bunch of times now. I know, listeners, this has been a big issue for us on social media, on Facebook specifically. We've had a lot of debates going on about this, but we really needed to come back to it today because this week we have an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal from Kavanaugh himself. And he's making the argument that he's an independent, impartial judge, and he just had this emotional day the other day, and that basically it's because of all these unsubstantiated claims, and so that we need to kind of look past this. The other big news that happened on Friday is that the Senate passed the first vote to move forward the Kavanaugh final vote. So in the Senate, we have the we have a filibuster possibility, and so you have to then have a cloture vote. And so we have passed cloture, and it was fascinating because it comes in 51, a Democrat crosses over and makes it possible. So Athena, what do you think about, you know, the op-ed piece from Kavanaugh? That's kind of unusual in and of itself. And what do you think later on Saturday, what this holds for him and his possibilities? What do you think about that?
Okay, well, when I read the piece that Judge Kavanaugh submitted, I read it twice. And the first thing that came to mind was, this is his Hail Mary, if you will. When he spoke during the act, when he gave his testimony, he came across as, he was angry, obviously, somewhat belligerent. And he made references that could be construed as partisan in nature. And I read this piece that he submitted, and it was very apologetic. It has gravitas, but that was the gravitas that we needed to see when he actually spoke before the committee. He allowed his emotions to get the best of him. And while all of us are human and are subjected to, you know, act according to our emotions, we have this expectation that our members of the judiciary will comport themselves in a way that doesn't seem as though it is as influenced by his emotions, his feelings. And so when I go back and watch his testimony and I read this, I'm trying to reconcile both of these. I don't really see how he can promise in the op-ed piece that he is going to be impartial and that he will exercise this gravitas that we expected him to have, but he didn't demonstrate. So it's almost as if it's a little too late, if you will.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting. One of the things that I think he tries to set up in the piece, in the op-ed, is he says, look, I have answered thousands of questions. I've talked to nearly all of the senators. And I think he's setting his performance up as an outlier to his behavior. And I think in some ways, he's making a similar argument to the allegations. He's like, look, this one moment in response to unsubstantiated allegations, anybody would be upset. But look in this in totality here, right? I have, in all of these very deep details, released myself to the Senate, bared myself to the Senate. Can't we suspect maybe that I can understand why I would be a little upset? I mean, do you find that to be a sympathetic argument on his behalf, or does that just continue to support your view? Wait a second, he can't be impartial.
Well, he says in his piece, and I quote, "The Supreme Court must never be viewed as a partisan institution." Yet he couched his argument in terms of some sort of revenge by the Democrats. And so I'm thinking, okay, you have contradicted yourself here, because you brought partisanship into this with your rebuttal. And now you want to say that partisanship has no place in the Supreme Court. So it's like you're telling me one thing, and then you write that you plan to do something else. And to be quite honest, I question, why are we all sticking with this one justice? You know, the job of the Senate is to advise and consent with regard to these nominations. The nominations are not rubber stamped. And it is the duty of senators to, you know, dig deeper into these people who will be holding these positions of prestige, in particular the Supreme Court. So my question becomes, when I'm reading all of this and, you know, the news cycles are inundated with this story, I'm thinking, why can't the president nominate another conservative who is above reproach? Somebody that we don't have to hear about these things.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting question. As a matter of fact, it's one of the ones a couple of weeks ago now that I brought up on social media. You know, had I been working for the president, you know, I think it would have been easy enough way earlier in the process to basically say, look, we've got some weird things coming up now. Why don't we just switch this, make life easier, move forward? But, you know, that's not the style. I mean, listeners of the show know that I have no love lost for the president. But that is simply not Donald Trump's style. And I think in the case of Republicans, I think the problem here is that for Republicans, they just see this as being a needless retreat. They're like, why should we have to retreat from an allegation? And I think that is, I think that's fundamentally why Republicans don't want to back down. And certainly Donald Trump, I mean, that's just not his style. He's the man who wants to punch. And clearly we can see that he was excited by Kavanaugh's original response. He tweets his support of that. Now, In counterpoint to that, it is interesting. I don't know if many listeners have noticed, though, that former Judge Kennedy, has actually said that he no longer supports Kavanaugh. He thought that originally this should move forward, but then after watching and reading the op-ed, he now thinks, in kind of an ironic twist, in my opinion, that he doesn't support the judge anymore and the nomination forward anymore. But I don't think that's going to matter pragmatically speaking. I mean, there's going to be a vote tomorrow and it's going to be close. So what do you think on that pragmatic outcome, whatever Donald Trump should or should not do? What do you think happens on Saturday?
I think on Saturday we get a 50-50 split. Vice president, whose only constitutional job is to preside over the Senate, he will break the tie. We know that he is a staunch conservative because he's driven by religion, by his particular religion, his evangelicism. Part of that theology is that all life is sacred. So, of course, he would be anxious to have someone on the court who could possibly cast the deciding vote in overturning Roe versus Wade. So I think that if the senators are a 50-50 split, Pence will vote to confirm.
You don't think they're gonna vote along the same lines of cloture, that they're gonna actually need Mike Pence?
I think so. Because, well, right now we're not 100% sure, because Murkowski is expected to vote no. At least the last thing I read said she's expected to vote no. Manchin, we're not sure what he's going to do. So he could be one of those that defects, so to speak, and votes with the Republicans, or he
which
could
he did
stand
on, which
with
he did on the cloture. Exactly.
Yeah. You know, we're looking at a very real possibility of a 50-50 split. And if Pence breaks the tie, then Kavanaugh's confirmation, well, from what I can tell, would be the closest in margin than any we've had.
You know, that's an interesting question. I didn't even look at that. I don't know if there's ever been a Supreme Court nominee who has won on a tie-breaking vote from the vice president. That's an interesting question.
Yeah, I can't remember if there was one. And I do know that when Thomas was confirmed, the margin was, what, 4, maybe 3?
Yeah, but it was definitely not a tie. Yeah.
Yeah. So this should be interesting.
No, I agree. And I think I agree with you on the outcome. I'm not sure it's going to be a tie. One of the things that I took a look at, it's interesting to see that despite a lot of the negativity about Trump remaining entranced with Kavanaugh, if you take a look at his rolling averages, his presidential approval, has gone up during the Kavanaugh time, and his disapproval numbers have come down. And again, that can be a blip. I don't want any of our listeners to think that we need to read too much into that. It's always difficult to tell the noise from the actual weekly and daily polling data. But, you know, we do have a couple of weeks of this now, and it is fascinating that we do have a micro trend emerging, which suggests to me that some of these Democrats in more difficult seats may think twice about it and prefer, you know, picking up some House seats and some Senate seats in the midterm election over potentially, you know, trying to be the vote that brings down Kavanaugh. Now, again, I'm not positive, but I mean, I think either of ours is plausible. It's just a fascinating conversation, and I guess we'll have to wait at the earliest later on Saturday to find out what's going to happen with that. Probably more likely Sunday, so we'll see. And I'm sure that Mike and Jay will be taking that up next weekend. Mm-hmm. But what we want to move to next, if you're interested, Athena, is another big item. It didn't get as much news as I think it really deserved, given the amount of oxygen that got used up, was the replacement of NAFTA, what some people are calling NAFTA 2.0, and that's the USMCA, or the United States Mexican Canadian Agreement.
Right.
And, you know, this is a big keep for Trump, a promise keep for Trump. He wanted to look at a NAFTA. He was going to get rid of it. We're going to get a better deal. I mean, better deals. That's been his, that was his campaign move. And the changes are relatively broad in the areas that he wanted. The big changes, there's others. The big ones, though, are we're going to change the way we think about how cars are produced, the percentages of where and where they count from coming.
Right.
There's some labor provisions in there. The big, big one that Trump was not going to move on was access to Canadian dairy markets, which was a big deal for him. And then obviously the intellectual property side of things, bumping up ownership after the death of authors up to 70 years. And there's some interesting deals taking place in here as it relates to any potential China deals, especially with Canada, because non-market economies have to get approval of the other members to get into them, which would mean theoretically it's going to be tougher to have kind of free trade deals with China moving forward.
Exactly.
So what are your thoughts about NAFTA 2.0 or that mouthful, USMCA?
I was calling it the Trump Trade Agreement, or TTA, make it easier on me.
Yeah, we need something. We really do.
As I was reading about this, I questioned, you know, I understand that, you know, part of the desire to revamp the agreement was so that the United States could come out a bigger winner on the other side. However, I read this, and when I was doing my preparation, I also thought about what gets produced where. So, you know, the word supply chain is, you know, part of the lexicon of many businesses. So how exactly are we going to take the reins as far as a larger portion of the supply chain when it comes to these three countries? I don't understand exactly where we are going to, how that's going to happen, because, you know, all of these companies, all of these products that go into making a car, for instance, the United States doesn't do all that. And it made me think about the Chinese hacking case, which hopefully we'll talk about later. It's like you have different components coming from different areas. So how is the United States planning on securing that? What was the percentage that said that?
So the fundamental deal is that 75% of the components from cars have to be manufactured in Mexico, the United States, or Canada to qualify for the zero tariffs. In other words, they can't be coming from third party sounds weird when you have three parties in an agreement, from non-signatory parties.
Okay, but does the current administration understand that capital comes in different forms, and maybe there is a form of capital that we don't have available here or within this North American cluster of these three countries that we can produce and produce sufficiently enough to provide a component which will allow us to keep the price of those cars down? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, in the basically, it will be more difficult to get the zero tariff policy for cars under the USMCA rather than NAFTA. Mm-hmm. Under NAFTA, obviously, I shouldn't say obviously, listeners, under NAFTA, it was 62.5% of the vehicle had to be made in one of the three signatory countries to get the zero tariff deal. And so if enough parts are being made in a non-signatory country, this will take it, and I'm forgetting what the tariff is, but it takes it up from zero. So what this basically does is it requires a bigger proportion of vehicles to be made in either Mexico, the United States, or China.
Right.
I mean, okay. I'm so sorry, Canada. I said China.
Canada. All right. So, that's promising, but I'm still waiting to see. I mean, when it comes to economics, I'm not an economist, but I am aware of specialization of trade, and that, you know, based on a country's distribution of human, natural, and capital resources, they will focus more on one particular area, whether you produce labor intensive goods or capital intensive goods. And the percentages that we were able to produce under the original trade agreement, they seem to work. But aren't we talking about a roughly 13% increase in the percentage of components
that
have to be made here?
Yes.
Who's to say we have that?
Well, I don't think that the Trump administration is arguing to have that. I think what they're attempting to do is to impose larger tariffs on a greater number of vehicles coming into the United States. And I think that's consistent. You know, again, my ideological background is one. I'm a free trader, as listeners know. But I think Donald Trump here, I mean, this is potentially a win for him in the sense that he is not a free trader. He wants to increase tariff barriers, and he wants to bring things more local, specifically inside the United States. Now, this obviously isn't just inside the U.S., but I mean, as a whole here, Athena, do you think this is a win for the Trump hardline negotiation, kind of backing away here, as you're noting specifically on automobiles, from closer to a free trade set of things to a more protectionist view of the economy? And so do you think this is a win? Do you think this is a positive direction going towards a more protectionist view? What are your thoughts on that, Athena?
I think from a rhetorical perspective, this is a win. for the administration, because supporters of that administration will say, okay, well, our president took a stand where the previous president didn't. And so now more will be produced here, which will be translated into those components, those materials must be produced, you know, within these three countries, preferably here. You know, we will be putting pressure on, you know, manufacturers to bring their companies here. And it may sound good, and it makes for great stories, but from a practical perspective, to what extent will we see these companies choosing to voluntarily come back to the United States just for the sake of providing, you know, some component or some commodity or whatever? And this agreement, from what I understand, doesn't it have like a sunset date of like 16 years. So hypothetically speaking, let's say that the administration approaches several businesses to try to get them to come back to the United States and produce here, as opposed to using foreign labor, as opposed to using countries that have a large and inexpensive labor force. All right. How do you convince the shareholders in those companies to come back? Because invariably it will mean, you know, you go from a inexpensive labor force to a more expensive one, which means that the profits are going to decrease. This may work for one or two companies, but what about all that would be involved, mm-hmm. you know?
So Athena, because I know that, you know, you're new to listeners, and so I'm wondering, what is your kind of take on trade? Do you have one? I outed myself to you, as listeners already know, mm-hmm. as being the free trader. It mm-hmm. sounds like you kind of come down on that side, but I don't want to speak for you. So what are your kinds of views on trade in general as it relates here to NAFTA?
I take into consideration that when it comes to how resources are distributed, some countries have more of one and less of the other. So if we're talking about human, natural, and capital resources, there are going to be some things that other countries have more of and things that they have less of. And so from a trade perspective, it just makes sense to take advantage of what your strengths and weaknesses are when it comes to these resources. You know, the United States, we're a country that we have large amounts of capital. You know, we have very high standards with regards to technology. We've been at the forefront of technology. We have greater education. And yeah, we have a pretty large workforce, you know, or a number of people who could be in the workforce. But at the same time, we have companies that know that if they stay here, then they are going to be losing profit, because at the end of the day, many of these companies, in particular the ones that are public, they answer not to the workers, unfortunately, but they answer to their shareholders. I read a book called The Big Shift several years ago, and it talks about how the Great Risk Shift. And it talks about how, you know, we've seen how attitudes in business have changed, where they used to be worker-centric. Now it's more about the bottom line. And I think that if a company is taking that into consideration, where they know that we lack certain resources here, but somebody else has the resources that we need there, and overall it builds the strength of our company, then let's utilize it.
Well, you know, let's kind of take that on a little bit and move forward, because this week, one of the other stories that was really fascinating to me, as listeners know, I'm a big tech guy, and Bloomberg had a huge piece called The Big Hack. And specifically, I think in some ways it kind of relates to these international trade policies. And, I know a lot of listeners have pushed back on me for my free trade positions. And this is probably one of the areas where there's maybe some of the most legitimate pushback, in my opinion. And that is we had this big potential hardware hack. So listeners, if you aren't sure, I encourage you to go take a look at the Bloomberg report. But the short version is that operatives from China had access to producers who were creating boards for Supermicro. Now, if you're just a consumer electronics person, you've probably never heard of Supermicro, but they're actually a company that produces the boards that are used in large-scale computers. So, meaning your cloud computing, effectively. So your Facebooks, your Amazons, your Apples. And what happened was they were actually attaching this tiny chip to the board, which allowed them to have a hardware hack. Hardware hacks are really significant, listeners, because it doesn't require, it's nothing you can fix. So if there's a software hole in your operating system, you can come in, you can make adjustments, you can patch that hole once you figure out what's going on. There's actually no way to patch a hardware hack. Now, usually though, the way you get hardware hacks is you have a targeted hack. So you'll have a man in the middle. That's what the CIA likes to do. So they want to grab devices in route to the person and have some kind of hack on it. In this case, we're talking about at the manufacturing side. Now, Apple and Facebook have denied that this is accurate, but there's been a number of senior level administrator officials, both inside the White House and now from Apple, who have said, yeah, this is possible. And they have actually said that there's been a software hack. But let's just go back to the hardware side, because I think it kind of fits to the Trump model, which says, look, you don't want to export the creation of sensitive devices, because this puts these kinds of possibilities into the hands of potentially malicious actors. So what do you think about the hack? And do you think that it legitimizes the views of some who argue that we need to have more manufacturing in the United States?
Okay. The hack in and of itself is scary, because, you know, they talk about the microchip, and it's, I think the article said it was probably the size of a sharpened pencil lead.
So yeah, it almost looks like a resistor.
Yeah. And from what I could tell, the article said it doesn't really hold a lot of information, but it doesn't have to, because it serves as the conduit between that server and a computer elsewhere, or another server elsewhere, which can come in and cause greater damage, where you can see the system being rewritten, you can see the malicious data, you know, being added, the Trojan horses, but most importantly,
it effectively allows a non-sequence of a password. Yeah, precisely.
Exactly. You know, and I was reading this, and for me, I could tell certain things could happen. Like, for instance, this has the potential to further compromise our relationship with China. We were wary before, but, you know, this can make an already tenuous relationship even more strained. Also, we have to figure out, like, if we chose to, how do we move China away from the supply chain? We can't, because, you know, they have cheap labor, they're skilled, they have a manufacturing infrastructure in place, and they also have, you know, rare earth mineral mining capacities across different countries, not just in China, but, you know, China has a pretty significant foothold on the African continent. How does the United States, how do we put ourselves together, figuratively speaking, in a way that we would be able to make up for the shortcomings of trying to move China out of the supply chain.
Well, I think the administration's I think the administration's point is that we make the kinds of moves they were doing against NAFTA, assuming obviously it gets passed in the Senate, and have more protectionist policies that effectively we need to make it more expensive to do business in China, so that companies will stay in the United States and will get these additional benefits by being in the United States. Things like we don't have to worry about Chinese malicious actors putting things on our hardware. And so what do you think to that? I mean, is that a valid point of view, or do you think, like me, do you think that there is a there's still a case to be made for the needs of free trade, and what would that look like?
Being able to produce everything that you would like to produce in your own country sounds great in theory, but I don't see it coming to fruition in practice. It would be really, really difficult for us to not only be able to produce every single thing that we as Americans like to use, but also it wouldn't be possible, at least it doesn't come across as being possible, that we would still be able to enjoy the products that we use that are put together vis-a-vis this supply chain at the same cost. So we have to figure out, you know, which of the two evils is the lesser. Do we try to become more protectionist and at the same time realize that we can't produce everything here? Or do we, you know, maintain the supply chain but try to keep China in check, if you will, you know, so that they won't hack? And of course, I surmise, I don't speak Chinese, but I surmise that one of the things that's probably been said in the Chinese state-run media about this, if this issue is as important to them as it is to us, they would say, well, the United States did it to us first.
Yeah, I mean, the official line has been that, you know, this hasn't happened. It is, in fact, made up. This is bad reporting. Now, Apple and Facebook, they've argued that the hardware hack is, in fact, inaccurate, but instead that it was a software hack, and they basically discovered it before it became worse. But the Chinese position basically has said, the official government line has been, you know, there is nothing going on here, you know.
Right. And I wanted to also mention that, you know, when I was talking about the United States' possible inability to produce all the components of the things that we like, there was a story in the Harvard Business Review that the title of the article says, the U.S. cannot manufacture the Kindle, which signals that many of the technologies we enjoy here cannot be wholly manufactured. And, you know, there was another story on motherboard that said that, you know, even if it was possible, because it was in response to the president saying, you know, telling, I think it was Apple, that you should make the iPhone here. And the article was basically addressing how we wouldn't be able to produce the items, all of the items, to allow for iPhone production. But, you know, as sort of a consolation, instead of the iPhone being made in America, produced in America, the best we could hope for is that it would be assembled in America. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So, you know, I think what we might want to do, because I know we're starting to come short on time, because we're going to have some unique listener set of questions this week, is I think we want to turn to one last story, which is the New York Times did an in-depth piece on the money of Trump, the Trump finances. And this, I think, in a different week would have gotten a whole lot more traction as a story. And the story that Trump has generally told, although obviously his tax returns are still not released, so we can't look at, you know, details in many ways, but what we've seen is that the Times has argued that about 413 million of his father's real estate empire came to Trump, and it has come to Trump. In other words, he's had a lot of family money through some really dubious tax schemes, particularly during the 1990s, including what the Times called outright fraud. So do you think this is just part of the of a building pattern as on Trump? Do you think this will have any effect on the Trump or the midterms, or is this just yet another blip in the, hey, Trump does some shady things, but it doesn't apparently affect his overall popularity, et cetera? What do you think about that, Athena?
It has, I would say it has no effect, or doesn't have as strong of an effect as perhaps, you know, his antagonist would want it to, because there is nothing to compare it to. Right now, we don't have access to his tax returns because, you know, he's refused to release them. It's possible maybe we'll see some of these tactics employed in his tax returns if they were ever released. But, you know, that issue is pretty much moot because he's already decided he's not going to do them. So while this is interesting and, you know, could perhaps provide some sort of a roadmap should the taxes be released, I don't see him giving consent for his tax returns to be released to the American public for us to review and scrutinize. And plus, in that article in the New York Times, one of the things that that was said was a lot of these, you know, loans and whatnot were considered illegal, and there's nothing that you can do about them now. But who's to say that, you know, a thorough examination of Trump's own returns wouldn't show some of these same tactics being applied in the money that he has and in the taxes that he's paid, or rather hadn't paid. So right now it's interesting. It's the kind of thing to sort of maybe keep in the back of your mind. And I wanted to also mention that Showtime is actually doing a documentary on this tax story. I think it's this weekend.
Oh, I had no idea about that.
Yeah. Right now, it's an interesting thing to read, but as far as his supporters are concerned, there's no there, if you will. And for the most part, they're right, because until his tax returns are released and people are allowed to scrutinize them, you know, knowing that his father and his brother and his sister, and he did all of this before his father died, it's sort of irrelevant. But once we get his tax returns, we can compare what Trump Sr. did to protect family wealth with what Trump Jr. might currently be doing to protect his family.
No, it's an interesting story, and I think you're right. Ultimately, that I don't think there's going to be a there for supporters. And as a matter of fact, I think even if we had the tax returns, I think for the most part, the ability to kind of manipulate these situations would probably be seen as a positive. I mean, this is something that came out even during his debate where he said, look, I'm not fraud. It's smart, right? I've paid no taxes. That's a smart thing. And I think many people are going to take that same point of view, right? So if you can get out of having to pay those taxes, why wouldn't you? Now, normally, listeners, this is when Athena and I would take on some listener questions, but I know that last week we had some really interesting questions from listeners from Leah Whitmer. So if you hadn't listened to this, Mike and Leah did the show last week, and we've had a ton of feedback. And so what we're actually going to do is that Leah graciously agreed to talk with us again and respond to your questions. So Athena and I are going to listen in as Mike and Leah have a little bit of a conversation and take on some listener questions this week, and then we'll join you again in a moment.
Last week, as part of our discussion of the Kavanaugh 4 testimony, I thought it was important to get a non-male perspective. And so I asked my friend Leah, someone who's political knowledge I've respected for a number of years now, if she'd be willing to provide her view, and which she did in the form of a summary statement that I read, after which Will and I discussed the testimony more generally. Now, a number of listeners took issue with, or maybe were unclear about, at least part of what Leah had to say, particularly how she closed with, I believe Dr. Ford, I believe women. There were some listeners who heard that and concluded that it was a form of sexism, sort of assuming the veracity of an accuser simply because of her gender. There's one of our listeners who put it like this: I don't believe women, I don't believe men, I believe evidence. And so I asked Leah if she'd be willing to come on the show and respond to this, and she graciously agreed, and she's here with me now. Leah, welcome, and thanks so much for coming on.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So I thought we could just maybe start by that statement, you know, that idea of, well, as one listener put it, it's you need to follow the evidence and not be concerned with the gender of the person. So what do you think about that?
Well, I'll talk about what it means to me in a moment. I can't be the voice for the Me Too movement or the Believe Women movement. It's just, I think it has a different meaning for everybody. But one thing I would encourage people to do is, if they want to know more about what I Believe Women means or what Me Too means, do an internet search and spend 20 minutes getting 20 different takes on what it means to different people and make up your own mind. Instead of assuming that it means believing all women, regardless of evidence, just because they're women, that's just not what it is. And I feel like if you want to gain perspective on what it means, you should do that. And then come ask the women you know in your life to talk about it and talk about what it means to them. So I just want to encourage everybody to sort of do a little bit of personal introspection before assuming that it means a certain thing.
Yeah, you know, I mean, my sense of what it meant, at least what I took it to mean, is that we need to understand that phrase. It's sort of a shorthand in terms of a much longer history of, well, heck, not just generations or hundreds of years, but millennia of women not being believed, of being blamed and shamed and so forth. And so it's just essentially sort of a short, pithy, punchy way of getting across this idea of we need to reverse our societal norm of assuming that women are these, you know, are these harpies trying to trap men and that sort of thing. And at least that's how what I take it to mean.
Yeah, I think you're right. But I think there's a little bit more to it. I think maybe that the 2,000, 6,000 years of rage that we've had, being boiled down into a couple of words, you know, it's not going to cover everything. But for me, Believe Women, I think, is a sort of moral imperative, that each person holds themselves accountable to, where it challenges me to sort of pause and give serious consideration to women's claims of assault and harassment, even when it's inconvenient, even when it comes at considerable personal or political expense. And it doesn't require the abandonment of the presumption of innocence. It just means that we think that each of these claims is valued and important enough to warrant consideration. And also that we believe that in most cases that the claims will stand up to scrutiny and investigation.
You know, I think a problem that a lot of people had heard the testimony is that Dr. Ford, they did believe Dr. Ford. I think it was hard to listen to that testimony, watch that testimony, and not. But by the same token, there were a lot of people who said, "Well, gosh, Judge Kavanaugh's testimony seemed very emotionally sincere and believable as well. And so then they kind of default to that. Well, if both parties are believable, we have to go by the weight of the evidence. And so what does that mean in terms of, you know, that kind of larger question of believability of women in general and so forth? And it becomes just a really fraught issue, I think.
Absolutely. And again, I have to separate out talking specifically about Dr. Blasey Ford and Brett Kavanaugh. That to me, I have to divorce these two things a little bit because I think giving a woman fair consideration, in this case, people's definition of fair consideration is different. So I believe they concluded a 7-day FBI investigation. Republicans say there was no credible evidence and Democrats say something else and we're never going to know, right? So in this particular instance, I do believe Dr. Ford. I don't believe Judge Kavanaugh told the truth about everything he said when he was testifying in front of the Judiciary Committee. I believe she has at least marginal corroborating evidence. I believe that he lied about small things, which indicates to me he's probably lying about larger things. But I can't use this particular instance to sort of and tie it directly to what I believe women means, right? I believe there was probably a lot of miscarriage of justice in this particular case.
Just coming from the president on down, this idea of women who are assaulted in any way, of course they would come forward immediately, and if they don't, therefore that's a sign of them essentially fabricating a story, indicates to me just an incredible lack of understanding of the context in which this happens and the culture in which this sort of thing has happened for a long time.
Is it a lack of understanding or just willful obfuscation?
I think maybe both, sometimes both in the same people. But I feel that on the Republican side, certainly there were plenty of people from Mitch McConnell on down who basically felt that unless there was some sort of a video of this thing happening, that this confirmation was going to be rammed through. And the lack of willingness to consider evidence, I think, to me, is one of the most troubling things about all this.
There are lots of troubling things about this.
Yeah, that's definitely true. Definitely true.
Yeah, but I mean, if there's, you know, I'm sort of mired in it right now, and it's hard to see, it's hard to step outside of it and see any positivity coming out of this. But if there is, I think it comes, if there, it's in that it has advanced the discussion of sexual assault. And that's what Me Too has done. And it's what I believe women is doing in order to make sure our kids and the next generation don't inherit the same shame that women today have. We have to free ourselves from our own sexual shame. And we're doing that in a couple of ways. For a lot of women, it means coming forward at great personal expense to confront powerful men about ways that they have been abused or harassed. When, you know, honestly, I can in my own life look back and be like, I was a bartender for a long time and I put up with a lot of things that crossed the line because I thought it was the way it was supposed to be. I just thought it was just a cultural norm. And I think coming forward and saying those things out loud, especially to the people who did them, and especially in front of an entire nation, exercises a lot of the shame. And for men, I think there's also a lot of confronting that they need to do. I think they can exercise their own shame by confronting their own actions towards women, or, you know, times they stood by and listened or watched as women were treated disrespectfully or harassed or assaulted. And so I think there is a cultural shift happening. And I think Me Too and Believe Women are part of it and are really advancing the discussion of these things, where a lot of women, a lot of men may not realize that their actions have had consequences beyond what they realize.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, like I said, I really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to get on with me and talk about this. As I said, I value your perspective, and I think listeners should get a lot out of it as well. So thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, I just want to let you know, as we kind of exit out the show, Athena, thank you again for joining me this week on The Politics Guys. I hope you've had a lot of fun.
I did. Thank you. Thank you so much for the invitation.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. We're loving to have a different kinds of points of view. And one of the things that I want to ask you listeners is to give us your feedback. How have you liked the show today? Tell us what you think about Athena. We're actually going to have a couple of other new guests on the show the next few weeks, and we would love your feedback on all of them. So if you are a longtime listener, you probably already know this, but let me tell you anyway. If you head to politicsguys.com and you can send us your feedback on this episode or others. You can also reach us out on social media at politicsguys on Twitter or facebook.com/politicsguyspage. You can also always email us at mail@politicsguys.com. We also want to remind you that this show is possible because of supporters. Supporters like many of you who are listening right now. And if you would like to join that supporter club, please head to politicsguys.com/support, and you can hit us up on Patreon or PayPal. And that's what makes this possible. And if you can't right now support the show, if you can subscribe on iTunes, rate episodes, share episodes with friends, that helps us significantly. I'd also like to let you know, I would like to apologize for my voice this week. I have been suffering from some severe upper respiratory infections, and so I'm on lots of medication right now. But so if you're wondering, why does Trey sound so bizarre? No, it's not a new voice I'm trying out. I'm still just recovering. So Athena, if you join us again, I will sound very different next time. So I thank you for all the listeners who have who are willing to kind of take my voice aside this week. I'd like to note that the executive producers of The Politics Guys are Michael Baranowski, Jay Carson, Trey Orndorff, and Bruce Johnson. This episode is produced by Trey Orndorff. We'll have a new show on Wednesday. We hope you'll join us then.